Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another episode of Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mitch Michaels from the Santa Monica Studios. Delighted as always to bring you another episode covering the game you know and love. It is the tennis offseason for a few weeks, so we're taking this time on this podcast to bring you some special guest interviews with some standout individuals in the game. And this week we have a banger of an interview with Mike Cation, Mike C. Tennis on Twitter. He is the voice of the USTA Pro Circuit. He has been for 10 years. Mike was very, very generous with his time. Probably the hardest working man, not just in tennis, but maybe in all sports. And we'll get into that on the show, what his daily and weekly schedule is on the pro circuit, how he got into that role, how he has gained the respect of his peers, and some of the players like Ben Shelton, Nick Kyrgios, Chris Eubanks that he saw work their way up the ladder, signs of greatness, Jannik Sinner, another one, what his outlook is going forward, his broadcasting style, all this and more with Mike Cation, the voice of the USTA Pro Circuit, on this week's episode of Tennis Channel Inside In. It's a great interview. I hope you enjoy it. Let's start the show. All right, welcome everybody to Tennis Channel Inside In on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. Mitch Michaels from the Santa Monica Studios, delighted now in our off season. We don't have many weeks. We got to take advantage of it and promise some interesting stories, interviews, different perspectives in our limited time away from pro tennis. Joined now by the voice of the pro circuit. He's been in that position for over a decade now, has had a lot of broadcasting and voiceover work as well. Hosts a podcast, Behind the Racket, on the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. And many say, and I can understand why, that he's the hardest working person in all tennis. Mike Cation joins the show now. Mike, been waiting to do this for a while. Thanks so much for your time coming on the show.
Now, Mitch, I'm really honored as a frequent listener and part of the podcast network. I listen all the time, and so it's really an honor to be with you here today.
Appreciate that a ton. I wanted to get to your story because it's an interesting one, and it's somebody that is living out their dream, as we know, and we will get to. But you came up in the tennis community as a competitive athlete. I don't want to shortchange that at all. You know, we can't.
I shortchange it quite a bit myself.
Only a very, very select few can make it all the way to the pro game. But you were a pretty good junior player coming up and had the opportunity, a potential career that was cut short via injury at the D3 level. But you had the tennis bug early, I think it's safe to say. And what was it about just falling in love with the sport first as a player, now, of course, as a broadcaster?
Yeah, for me early on, I've said this before, John McEnroe is the one. You know, when I was really, really young, seeing him act like a fool sometimes, go crazy on a court, but then also have this incredible high level. And then as I got older and just more invested in the sport and started competing myself, it was much more about just that one-on-one battle. The chess game that is tennis, right? When you know what your skills are, you know what your opponent's skills are, and how those two things match up, how you have to counter what they might be doing on that given day. And I just really enjoyed the individual hyper competitive, on court for about an hour and a half, you give everything you can. And I thought that really suited me as well. It allowed me as a competitor to be adaptive, really kind of figure out who I was as a person, and then as a player as well. And I think that tennis really does have that capability of translating into life very well. And I think nowadays, what I appreciate about the sport now is just those incredible stories of those people, those players who are at the highest level, and what it has taken for them to get to that point where they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the skill sets that they bring, and also the difficulties of life on tour. That's been the most interesting part for me as I've done this broadcasting component for 10 years now.
Yeah, and that's very well said. There's something unique about tennis. It's almost hard to describe, but it is. It has elements of every little thing. Like, it's a one-on-one sport. You're out there battling. You can't run out the clock. You have a different story for each player, and these tournament fields are so big. There's so many different stories in them. Your career and your path to this, you end up going, and I know you're a Champaign guy, right? From Champaign, Illinois, originally. So Champaign, you went to college locally. And I say locally like it's a small school. You went to one of the biggest, you know, most intense schools there were. But you go to Illinois, and if I have this right, you wanted to, you know, you got a broadcaster degree, but it wasn't always sports. It wasn't always going to be sports. When did that, you know, start to form that, okay, I can work in this industry now?
Yeah, so I my path right out of college, I got a job as a news director for a radio station. First for about 9 months in a very, very small town in Missouri. And then I was able to actually get a news director position at a group of radio stations in Champaign, Illinois. And actually the way I got back involved with sports was one of the first few interviews I did was with Craig Tiley, who at the time was the head coach at the University of Illinois. And when I was 15, 16 years old, to kind of show you where he was at the time, he was just starting as the head coach at Illinois and wasn't making any money. Wow. So he was having to give group lessons, not even private lessons, but group lessons on the side. And I was part of that, took some private lessons from him. So I learned about tennis from him. And then one of the first interviews I do is with him. And he says, hey, listen, I need somebody who can be a public address announcer for my team, who can help with the challenger that we have and still have in Champaign, do some of the PR and maybe help with a little bit of PR for my team as well. So I was able to find just a balance between this news and entertainment radio stuff. I mean, Mitch, you're much younger than me, but back in my day, you know, top 40 radio was like, that was king in a smaller town like Champaign-Urbana. That was, you know, that was a big, big deal. So to be part of a top rated morning show, that kind of, you know, paid the bills. But then my spare time was public address announcing for Illinois tennis, Illinois baseball. Then it got to Illinois basketball, which was a big, big deal, the biggest sport on campus. And then because of the fact that I got involved with the challenger in Champaign, I started to meet people. And then when this job, this pro circuit job, opened up in 2013, people said he loves the sport of tennis. Wow. He's got a very good radio background. Let's give it a shot. And there I was in 2013 announcing my first ever tennis match.
It's such a fascinating and inspiring story. It also shows you how timing in life is everything. Like this guy, Craig Tiley, who's now running tennis, you know, the Australian Open and everything. Yeah. He was there in Champaign. You have a challenger there, but you put the work in to be ready for that situation. Did you ever do any like mock-up play-by-plays or any broadcast? You just, wow, that's awesome. I just dove in.
Winnetka, Illinois, the week of July 4th, 2013. I had never done it at all. And, you know, I obviously, you know, much like you, Mitch, I mean, we're broadcasters, right? Like, so we know broadcasting, we've listened to tennis play-by-play for so many years, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that ability to kind of translate it. But if I were to go back, if I could find that broadcast, I've never watched it, but if I went back and watched that first week, there are some highlights because we had a pretty infamous moment with Alex Bogomolov Jr. that week, just walking off the court mid-match. And so it was one of those viral moments back in 2013. But my knowledge of the game then versus my knowledge of the game now, or it's night and day. I was ignorant at that time. And I'm sure if I were to go back, I would cringe at some of the comments that I made about why people were doing certain things. But I'm so lucky to get to listen to players and coaches in a hotel, you know, lobby breakfast, because we're staying at the same hotel at a challenger. So I get to listen to those players talk about why they do what they do. What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And it's been a massive learning opportunity for me.
One of the things I've read about yourself and comments you've made is that you have to, you know, as a broadcaster, one of the tricks is just manage your ego. Don't put yourself in the forefront. It's not about you. And I know your nature is not to be very, let's call it hot takey or just, you know, stark like that.
Yes.
Where did you develop that style? Is that just in your DNA, or was that through time, as you said, starting in 2013 and learning that this was the better way to go?
Well, I think part of it is, I don't like attention drawn to me at all. My parents raised me to be one of those people. You put your head down, you do the work, you do the work to the best of your ability. And praise, whatever that might mean, more money, a bigger title, whatever that might mean, will come along with it. I don't know that that's necessarily true nowadays, as I think we all know in this industry. But it's, I've kind of come to grips at my age now, in my mid 40s, that I'm content with doing the work, and that's what makes me happy. So the hot take stuff, like it's troublesome from a journalistic background, right? You go through and you just realize you're just supposed to do the work, do the reporting. I think I'm just happy with that now. I think also part of it is frankly, I am in intimate settings with these players. You know, I can sit here and just, I'll tell you, I'll put it in this way with an anecdote. I remember Patrick McEnroe is somebody who I consider a friend. He came in to the Dallas Challenger one year, maybe 2016 or so. And he sat in and did about 10 minutes of just kind of an interview broadcast while we were doing a match, right? And Dennis Kudla was playing. Dennis Kudla, his career high is 51, 53, somewhere like that. He's made millions and millions of dollars, a very successful player. I just remember Patrick saying, and, you know, he could be, he's obviously been proven right, that for Dennis, you know, he hit a forehand, just a routine miss. And he said, and that's why Dennis is never going to be top 10 or top 20, which is a pretty hot take early in a player's career to have. Right? Okay. It's proven to be right. But I found myself thinking that if somebody who's at a challenger level is saying things along that, those lines while you're doing a broadcast, why would anybody watch?
Well, that's,
You know, if there are 32 players in the draw, maybe two of them are going to get seeded at a Grand Slam. Maybe three of them get seeded at a Grand Slam at some point in their careers. If I just sit there and you know, do hot take after hot take about why this guy stinks and why this guy stinks, it's nobody's going to come back and watch. So I think part of the reality of my situation is that I just don't think there's a need for that.
Did you have influences, people you modeled your broadcasting style off, or like a composite? I know there's no, it's the worst thing to be a complete carbon copy of someone, but maybe a style, even if they didn't sound anything like you, that you tried to emulate?
Yeah, I was very young. I was drawn to Dick Enberg. I mean, very, very young, but I knew that that was like golden, that voice, that tone, you know, early in my life, I just knew. But I think in terms of influence, the ones that have influenced me most, not in terms of play by play though, were John Stewart. I love that delivery. And then, you know, again, my age difference here, Mitch, but the big show on ESPN SportsCenter, when it was Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick, and then the late show with Stuart Scott, Craig Kilborn, and some of those guys, like, I watched that day in, day out, and just kind of getting that feel for mixing humor with some just some political statements from time to time, but also just being so solid about when it comes down to the serious moments, being rock solid. And then there are obviously some ones that, you know, I've interacted with over the years, you know, people who I worked with, who I thought were incredible at what they did. The first job I ever had in a small town in Missouri, I did a couple football broadcasts and basketball broadcasts with a guy who was at the time probably 40 and had never left his town of 13,000 people, had never left it. He was the best broadcaster to this day that I've ever heard. Like, by John Covington. He was so good. He just, like, he spent so much time in doing his prep and putting it all together. I was floored, and still to this day, I think about how hard he worked to make it so that he was just able to be prepared and just do the job on the night of.
It is a fascinating thing to think about, right? Like, you want to find balance, you want to interject humor, you want to, you know, not take everything so serious, because it is a game, it's fun, it's exciting, but also highlight when those serious moments are. And I think just have a good time with it. If you're having a good time calling a match, I think that the viewers are going to identify that. But what I wanted to get to now was the stuff that I think makes you a little bit of a legend here. I want you to set the record straight on, you know, the matches and exactly what your days look like and how, you know, I saw the tweet you put out where in the last 10 years, it's like 3,700 challenger matches, but a typical day for you at a venue looks like what?
It's so first things first, I'll do my prep the night before or the morning of, depending on just the, you know, schedule, but I'm looking, you know, I'll start the day and I'm basically looking at anywhere between 4 and 8 matches. You know, just back-to-back solo commentary. So with that, let's take an average day, which would be about six matches. So that means I'm going to be doing prep on at least 12 players, maybe 14 or 16 if there's some doubles matches mixed in. The basics of my prep are, you know, just making sure I get the rankings right, live rankings, how many quarterfinals they've been in, depending on what round we're in, making sure that I'm cognizant of all of their previous last 6 weeks or so is what the way I put it together, last six tournaments. Just basically make sure I know where all their titles have come from. Then if I have a little bit more time, start putting in the thought of, okay, how do they play on clay? What's the speed of this court? How, you know, what are some comparable courts that they played on? And head to heads. So that typically will take me about 2 hours. There will be a coffee at some point during that stretch. That is obviously very important to make sure that the coffee is going during that day. But then, I mean, I try to get to the courts an hour to 45 minutes before the matches start. There is the component of I want to make sure I do at least one social media post in that morning of so that I can list all the matches that are being played. Here's the stream. Here's where you can find it. Might I point out, it is free to watch on the internet at all times to watch every challenger around the world. So I want to make sure people know here's these players are playing today. Come check it out. You can just come here, click it, done. You're good for the rest of the day. And then it's just literally sitting there. for six matches, right? I mean, that can go, what, 8 hours is an easy day. We've done as many as 15 and a half in one day. Yeah. That was, yeah, 10 a.m. to 1:30 one day in Dallas. That's a lot. Those breaks in between matches, that's about 10 to 15 minutes. You have to make sure you go to the bathroom if you need a snack. That's all in 10 or 15 minutes. And then you have to get back and make sure you are prepped and ready for just the intro of the match that's coming up next. I mean, it's no different than any other, mm-hmm. you know, Tennis Channel commentator that mm-hmm. they, you know, you have consecutive matches. So you have to do that short period, right? But then it's straight through. End of the day, you get a terrible dinner at Waffle House or something along those lines, as evidenced by this belly right here. But, you know, a good day is I get to exercise as well in the morning. But there's always that kind of mix of players now have that respect level for me. I believe that they'll bring me a coffee if I need a Diet Coke or something, you know, something, mm-hmm. the caffeine to help kind of push along. But yeah, it's just sitting there with a microphone, imagining there are people watching and interacting with me throughout and just going.
It's really impressive in a lot of ways that you're able to not just, you know, put the work in, obviously, like a true professional, but have the energy to do it. Because I don't think a lot of people are built for that kind of run. You described one day, and let's do it again five or six or eight times in a row. I know you do some interviews after at the championship levels, too. But what, you know, it's a broad question, but what kind of keeps you going to keep doing this in the sense of willing to do it that much, to do full slates? I know you have weeks off, but the ability to keep coming back to these tournaments and work the hours that I can't think of anyone in broadcast doing right now.
I appreciate you saying that first off, Mitch. It's very mm-hmm. kind of you. I love this sport. I just love it. And as I mentioned earlier, I've hit this point where, you know, I've kind of been able to appreciate that none of this is about me. I'm comfortable financially at this point, and I'm very privileged to say that. Mm-hmm. I know that these players, especially at the challenger level, don't often get their stories told, don't often get that ability to have somebody critiquing and talking about what they do within a match. And I want to make sure that I do that to the best of my ability that day. I'm so lucky that I've gotten to do so many podcasts and different TV outlet type of things talking about the players who have come through over the years. I mean, when Chris had the run last year, you were in Chicago with me when he was, you know, getting to the quarterfinals at Wimbledon. I remember that. And the amount of people who called me to try to get me on the podcast that week, so because I had the ability to talk to Chris for so many months and years. Ben Shelton the year before, JJ Wolf, all of these players, Jack Sock, Tennis Sandgren, all these players who've come through. And I'm lucky that I get to see them and see that incredible talent. Yeah. If I don't have an appreciation for that, I shouldn't be doing it. Yeah. And that's the same for every broadcaster, in my personal opinion. If you can't appreciate somebody who's working their butt off, maybe they're 150 in the world, like tell that story, get to know who they are, get to know what they do, and maybe what are the things that they do exceptionally well that can get them to that next level? What are those things that might hold them back? And just tell that story over and over again.
It's well said. It's special too. And I know you've been privileged enough to see some of your now friends make it to that level and be the person that's well, you know, in position to tell that story because you've seen the grind. It's not all silver spoons. It's some really talented players. Some really talented players can go right to the pros and have a career, but it's a very rare thing.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
More with Mike Cation here on Tennis Channel Inside In. I did want to lighten it up a little bit. I know that, and I got some intel on you as well. You're also at a point where you're a mainstay broadcaster. They know you. You'll get players talking to you a little bit on court like while matches are going on. Is that correct?
That is correct. I assume you've talked to Mr. Eubanks.
One difference. I have talked to Eubanks, but someone else, which you can probably figure out as well, too.
I've got an idea.
Yeah.
What I think people, one of the first things that I got criticized for, Mitch, early in my career was just, why are you so quiet? Like, this guy, I remember this. I shouldn't be reading Reddit and things of that nature, right? But, you know, we all do it from time to time. And just, why does this guy talk so quiet? He never says anything, all of these things. And I'm just like, I'm next to the court. I'm literally next to
the
court.
I've seen it, yeah.
You have seen it. I mean, it's there are times when I'm literally 6 feet or less from a player. If they come towel off, that's the corner I'm in. It's kind of a natural thing. There are a lot of players who don't have coaches, and so they just kind of need to release something in a way that's not destructive, you know, breaking a racket, whatever, you know, screaming at the umpire or something. But they'll just kind of look over and just be like, I got, you know, they need somebody to acknowledge that they're a person in that moment. Noah Rubin is one who I've had full on conversations with in the middle of matches, which is with the coaching rules now is a little bit iffy. Tennis Sandgren constantly early in his career would chat with me. Stefan Kozlov quite a bit. Ben, as he was coming up, Ben Shelton, he really kind of needed that somebody who wasn't a coach. It's not necessarily your question, but one of the biggest honors that I have is that people will want to have me just to out to dinner or something like that because of the fact I'm not a coach. I'm not a fellow player. Yeah. They need to blow off steam without having any repercussions of something negative that, you know, goes back to a coach or something like that. And yeah, we're kind of a traveling circus. Yeah. We all know each other. We all know each other's secrets and foibles. The conversation during the matches can be very, very interesting. And it's, very off the record.
For sure. Mike held a little low there. I think it's good to kind of just make sure that, you know, the players also are, you know, like you said, blowing off some steam. They look forward to you and they see you, as you said, like you're a traveling circus. You're with them all the time too. And then you call these matches, you carry these broadcasts as solo a lot, but I do think it's very cool and interesting the opportunities you've given some players, some other people to call matches with you. It is, and like a Tennis Channel, they're starting to do that here, obviously. But at that level, you're giving free on-the-job training to anybody who will take you up on it. And I think it's so cool. It's actually started some broadcasting careers right next to you.
Yeah, I mean, Chris did his first match with me in Knoxville a couple of years ago. He did win that tournament, I believe, 2021.
There's maybe a stat. There's a stat for you. It's like, who started their broadcast career winning a tournament? Probably just him.
That's probably right. He did a Jack Sock match, actually. Yeah. I do remember that because he was giving me some different takes on some of the things I was saying. So it was very, very interesting. But yeah, I think it's really important to continue to do that because I think a lot of players at that level are looking for a transition to whatever their next career might be. I mean, when Chris did that, for example, I mean, Noah's done it. Julia El Baba, who's now a broadcaster in New York City, she's done very well for herself. Alex Gruskin is somebody I've worked with over the last couple of years who's been doing a lot of T2 stuff with you guys. But I think a lot of players, if they kind of hit that point where they're maybe 26, 27, and they don't know what the next step for them is, they'll just say, hey, can I give this a shot? See if it's something that maybe I could do. I'm more than happy to do that. Just obviously the rules of, you know, learning how to broadcast, learning what not to say is probably the biggest thing, Mitch. I think you might agree.
Yeah, learning.
But I'm also very happy just to have company from time to time. It takes a little bit of pressure off of me, and they can learn. And again, those relationships you build, you never know if Chris Eubanks is going to be able to help me out someday. So I'm always happy to do that.
I think it's so cool that you're able to give them that opportunity. You know, there's no pressure. It's a chance. They're getting to, you know, dip their toe in. And for some like Eubanks, it works out very well. I wanted to ask you, because you brought up some players that came through Eubanks, one of them, Ben Shelton, last year. And I believe you were on, you know, you already started in your gig when Kyrgios was starting to come up as well, too.
That's right.
Those would be players off the top of my head. But who else have you seen that's really been like, wow, taking the challengers by storm, and then I guess didn't surprise you is a better way to put it, when they had pro ATP tour level success?
Yeah, Kyrgios was the first one in 2014. So I started in July of 2013. Jack Sock was playing at that time. Jack was much more difficult because of the fact that, you know, he hated playing a challenger. So it took him a long time as a result to escape it and get out. But it was clear that that talent, especially with the hand talent, that forehand is absurd. Kyrgios was the next one. He played 3 weeks with us. He, Tanasi, and Jason Kubler, who's now gone on to do very well. He won the first two tournaments, did Nick. He won Sarasota, beat Filip Krajinovic, who's done very well for himself. He beat Jack Sock in the final of Savannah the next week. Then he pulled out of the third week. And what I always will remember about Nick is, especially as he's been doing some work with you guys and doing a little media tour right now, he had to come to Tallahassee to pull out with a medical issue. He had to come to see the doctor on site so he didn't get fined. And he just, we'd never been able to do an interview. So he actually just hopped in and just did the broadcast with me just for like an hour of Tanasi's match. And I always will remember that because he always treats me incredibly well. I think he saw and just understood, you know. But yeah, when he had that breakout at Wimbledon a couple months later, not shocking. The next one that really stood out, we had Sasha Zverev for 1 week. We had Diego Schwartzman for 1 week. Neither of them impressed me during those weeks. I mean, he was obviously, the talent was very good. But the next big one was Sinner. He played two events. Binghamton, lost in the quarterfinals to, I believe, Mitchell Krueger, and then won Lexington the very next week. And I remember seeing him then at Qualies at the U.S. Open later, you know, 2 months later. And I said to one of the ATP staffers, I said, this is 2019. Within 5 years, he's going to win a slam. And I was just so sure of it. And now he's got one more year to actually with a slam. But I mean, Ben was pretty special. I think the story I've told before is just his incredible willingness to put big picture goals in front of small picture goals. The story I've told before, but it was the first round of a challenger in California in Tiburon. He played Roberto Quiroz, and he said before that match, he told his coach, he told his dad that he was going to serve and volley every single first serve, no matter what, for that entire match, even if that meant losing the match, because he knew that big picture, the next year, he was going to have to do it, and he committed to it. He went to a third set tiebreak. In the third set tiebreak, I thought he was just going to go away from it, serve and volley every single first serve. I was so impressed, and that was the moment where you knew the talent was there, but I was so sure of the fact that he was going to be very successful. And those are the things that, Mitch, when people ask me about who has stood out, it's always about those players who are not trying to win one match or you know, reach a quarterfinal. It's always those players who look at each day as development.
Yeah.
And that is a really hard thing to do, especially at that lower level where the money is not good at all, right? But those are the ones that stand out when you see a player who's just like, this has to get better. I'm going to do this. I'm going to commit to who I am at this level and just go after it. And I might lose today, but it's going to make me better later on. And those are the ones that stood out, and you're just like, I know they're going to be good quickly. And then there are stories like Chris and JJ Wolf. It took a little bit longer. You knew the talent was there, but that consistency level or belief, whatever it may be, wasn't necessarily there right at the start.
Yeah. And that last point, similar to, you know, your journey, anybody's professional journey, it's timing, it's opportunity with tennis. It's if the draw's right, is the body holding up, you know, you might get the break you hadn't had in years past. But it takes a lot of, it takes a lot of patience, I would say, to, you know, in Ben Shelton's case or anyone's case, to really sacrifice maybe short-term results to make an improvement that could help you in the long run. And it's tough when you have a limited window to have that patience. But it's such a special thing to see. And as, you know, someone that's been on the challenger level, the pro circuit for so long, I have to ask you the lighter question of funnier things or maybe peculiar things you've seen. Any moments that on a tennis court, I know you have a lot of stories in your head, so maybe you can filter out some good ones.
The number one, the first one was Marcus Willis, who then had the magical run at Wimbledon when he beat Tennis Sandgren while eating at the Knoxville Challenger while eating a Snickers and drinking an RC Cola. That was the first viral video, and that one was actually important for me because Chris Fowler, legendary broadcaster, he saw it and reached out to me. And I, like, that was the first moment where, like, a big broadcaster just, like, reached out and was just like, hey, I saw this. I didn't know they were doing this. But, you know, seeing Marcus at the time was probably 250, 280. And there,
safe estimate, yeah.
He had earned the nickname Cartman from South Park. And so he's, like, literally sitting there and just, like, eating a Snickers with his gut hanging out and beating Tennis Sandgren. So that was the first one. The one that I think everybody noticed, you know, brings up is I don't know. I'm trying to think about how to phrase this best. There were sex sounds
Sarasota
during a tennis match.
Yeah, I had that. Yeah. See, I was going to, yeah, your memory's too good. I was going to be like Sarasota, but, you know,
yeah,
Tiafoe and Kruger.
That was the.
That's yeah, probably.
Mitchell Kruger.
Yeah,
that Francis was. Francis Tiafoe.
That was everybody out there. And it was before Tiafoe blew up. We knew who he was. Yes. We didn't know the potential and what would end up happening. But yeah, you kind of, that was kind of when you first went viral for Sarasota in 20, because it happened in. It was such a long sequence. I'm not even trying to be funny now, but that was not just an isolated incident. And Tiafoe was hilarious. And you saw how funny Tiafoe was in that clip.
Yeah, we all knew Francis had the personality. And for him to be on the court at that moment, and if you've not seen it, you can still Google it. It's on YouTube in various different forms. But basically, there were sex sounds coming from a nearby apartment in the middle of the match. And it was so loud that it interrupted the match. And I had to continue broadcasting during it.
Yeah.
And Francis yells out, it can't be that good, at the loudness or the volume of the two people being intimate. That one was pretty crazy. And what's interesting about that, Mitch, is, you know, I was all of a sudden, I was doing broadcast, like, all sorts of national broadcasts. I was on NPR, for God's sakes, talking about it. Like, what is that about?
Wow.
But it was at first, the tournament didn't want anybody to talk about it. They didn't want it to be known at all. They were just like, this is terrible. You know, publicity for this, it should be about the tennis. And I want it to be about the. And I was just like, listen, you're going to get maybe 100 more people coming to your event on Saturday because of this. So, you know, take it in. But that one was crazy. Let's see. We've had a snake on the court. We've had lizards on the court. Yeah, there was one time we had to clear out the stadium at Cary because of a, I think it was a copperhead that was trying to get onto court. Yep. We've had tournaments canceled because of hurricanes. We've gone through hurricanes, where you're just kind of sitting and waiting for 3 days for the hurricane to pass. I mean, those are the ones that stand out. I mean, it's, yeah,
there's a lot.
There's a lot. It's crazy. And people always ask me, like, what it's so funny. Like, I just got back 2 weeks ago from the 3 week indoors in Charlottesville, Knoxville, Champaign. It's gone, Mitch. It is. It's like there are little things that kind of stand out, but most of it's just kind of like a blank slate, because when I get home, it's just like I'm full back into dad mode.
Yeah.
But you know, like the things that kind of stand out for me now, And there are always those light viral moments, but it's, I drove Marcus Willis and Dennis Kudla from Knoxville to Champaign this year, 8 hours in the car with those two. Mm-hmm. The friendship I've struck up with Noah and Chris Eubanks, for example, and even, you know, being invited to players' weddings is crazy to me. And those relationships are really what it's all about. And Francis, though, we always have a good laugh anytime we bring up Sarasota.
Yeah, you'll get some of the best like shots of the year at the Challenger event. Oh, you'll get viral moments. It's great. And I know the relationship with the players, there's been a few Instagram posts of, I think, you sleeping on couches in the lobby that they've kind of snagged to you. But I wanted to, you know, bookend this with this, Mike, as we kind of wrap up here on Tennis Channel Inside In, talking to Mike Cation, voice of the pro circuit. I was at, and it was just timing for me. We had the relationship. You're on the podcast network, and we've talked before. Chatted virtually, hadn't met you in person, met at the XS Tennis Center last year when they honored you for your 10-year anniversary. Mm. And so I saw the players, and they presented you, you know, with the cake, I believe it was, and it was a happy 10 years, and you have the players that were there, and the messages from the players that weren't there, in Eubanks' case, in the Wimbledon quarterfinals.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that was crazy.
It spoke a lot to the respect that your peers had for you, and I know as a broadcaster and as a professional, that is the number one, at least in my case, overarching thing is what your peers think of you. And that was really cool to see the level of respect that they had for you and the work you put into your craft.
I appreciate that very much. That was an incredibly humbling day. Chris was about to play, I think it was Medvedev was that particular day. He was about to beat Medvedev and, you know, sent that and lose to Medvedev. And I couldn't fathom that somebody would, you know, before the biggest match of their life, would take time out to do that. But you're absolutely right. And you know, it goes back to kind of what I was talking about with my parents, right? Like, put your head down, do the work. That respect is ultimately what matters most. As I said, I'm very lucky to do, this is what I wanted to do when I was 13 years old. If you'd have told me that I would have sold everything in the world at the age of 13 to do exactly what I'm doing right now. I mean, I have a neon sign with my name on it. I mean, you know, like these, all of these things that I would have wanted when I was 13, but you're absolutely right. All that matters is like, I know that those players at least understand that I'm putting in the work to make sure that I represent them well on air. I might get things wrong. Every broadcaster is going to get things wrong, but they know that I'm going to put in the time to make sure I do the best that I can. I'm very, very lucky that I've earned the trust of those players. I'm very lucky that I've earned the trust of other broadcasters, you know, who might need some details on a player that they might not have seen, but they're, you know, calling their match at a slam. And I'm always happy to do that. And you're absolutely right. That's the one thing that I always long for and I always take very seriously is making sure that I'm telling the story of whomever is in front of me the best way that I can on that particular day. And I'm really happy that it shows through and those players understand that.
Well, yeah, the tennis community could use more people with that kind of passion and drive. And it's very good to see your hard work rewarded and parlayed into other opportunities, getting the interview on court. Saw you in Toronto a little bit on there doing that. Yeah. And then Aussie and U.S. Open getting to travel, call the majors as well. Although Aussie's coming up, you know, that flight's not the best, but has to be a cool experience, though, to call the Grand Slam matches.
It is. Getting to call J.J. Wolf and Ben Shelton last year in that matchup was completely nuts, let alone calling Ben and Novak at the U.S. Open this past year. But it's one of my personal goals when I set out to do this 10 years ago was I wanted to be able to translate any success I might have to my family. And I'm getting to take my daughter, Marnie. She's coming with me to Australia. We leave on Christmas Day.
Awesome.
That's the one that draws the emotion out of me. It's just like, I get to bring my daughter down there so she can see Australia. That's pretty cool. But yeah, the Australian Open trip, I will take that 24-hour travel day every single day of the week to be at the Happy Slam without even thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a very, very deserved opportunity. Glad that the family is going to be around. And it doesn't sound like you have an end in sight. You're loving what you do. The energy's still there. There's no downturn. Yeah. This is like peak years for you, I think.
in theory, yeah. It's I mean, it's one of those things is, you know, with as an independent contractor, as all of us broadcasters are, as we go inside baseball a little bit here, Mitch, but, you know, that's, it can go away at any point. So the way I try to approach it is just appreciate every moment that you're given. I get to call a tennis match in a couple of weeks in Australia, and that is the coolest thing I could possibly think to do. And just appreciate that. And if I can make it another 10 years, I will be thrilled. And then, you know, follow my daughter around and be a good grandparent whenever she has kids too.
Wow. Yeah, that's the dream. That's a perfect outlook on it. And I just had the last thing of, you know, outside interest, still playing poker. And also got a shout out, apparently like myself, big Letterkenny fan.
Oh my God. I didn't realize there was a new Shorzy that came out like 2 months ago. I had no idea.
I'm mowed right through that. So
that's what I'm going to be doing tonight, quite frankly. Poker is, I've been kind of getting away from it. That was how I made money in 2020, which is crazy to me. But yeah, that's always the biggest thing. I run a lot. But then, you know, the biggest thing, Mitch, I'm like, when I'm home, I'm with my daughter. Like we're powering through Cat Quest 2 on the Nintendo Switch right now. Don't worry, you don't need to go buy that one.
Yeah. Thought about it.
But I run. I'll play poker when I have some downtime, but I just love spending time with my kid.
Well, it's perfect. Perfectly said. Mike Cation, voice of the pro circuit for a decade, still going strong. Thanks for coming on Tennis Channel Insight. And yeah, I got to give a shout out to, you know, Chris Eubanks and Blair Henley for helping me prep you a little bit. I know you knew that.
Blair. But,
Mike, pleasure as always. Check out the Behind the Racket podcast as well with him and Noah Rubin for some outstanding content. Love hearing you call matches, and thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
Once again, huge thanks to Mike Cation for joining the podcast. It is not an embellishment. I feel the way that many players and people around the sport do, that he is one of the hardest working, if not the hardest working individuals in the game. He carries the sport so well and tells the stories of all these tennis players that work their way up. So thanks to Mike Cation again. Best of luck for 10 more years and beyond covering the pro circuit. Follow him on Twitter at Mike C Tennis, and make sure you're listening to the Behind the Racket podcast that he does with Noah Rubin. They do a great job covering all the ins and outs of the sport. Behind the Racket, along with Tennis Channel Insight, and are members of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. You can go to tennis.com/podcast to find the entire catalog of shows on our outstanding network. And if you want to subscribe to Tennis Channel Insight and on any of your favorite podcast platforms, just search for the show. It will pop right up on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeart. Just search Tennis Channel Insight in, subscribe, leave a rating and a review to have all the episodes automatically downloaded to your listening device. So you don't have to do any work after that. Every Thursday, a new episode will just magically appear. It's not a Christmas gift or a Christmas miracle. It will automatically appear. Thanks again to everybody out there for listening. We've got more shows coming up at the end of the year and a best of show as well that you're not going to want to miss. For Mike Cation, my name is Mitch Michaels. This was Tennis Channel Insight In. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.